Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. It's the holiday season, and we celebrate peace on Earth, except in Syria. Oh, and Pakistan. And there's Egypt and Iran.
The Iranian charge in London is being informed now that we require the immediate closure of the Iranian embassy in London and that all Iranian diplomatic staff must leave the United Kingdom within the next 48 hours. It does mean that both embassies will be closed.
William Hague, British Foreign Secretary, talking to Parliament on Wednesday. And New York Times Chief Washington Correspondent David Sanger is here to talk to us about a hot week in the hot spots. Hi, David. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday, Brian.
Peace on earth to you.
You too. You too, although I think we're off to sort of a rough start of the month on that, as you suggested.
Maybe. And let's begin with Iran. There was this, what's the right word? Is it storming? Is it raid? What was it really at the British Embassy there?
I guess I would call it a highly coordinated attack that was meant to look spontaneous.
Coordinated by whom?
The best guesswork right now is that it was coordinated by something called the Basij Force, which is a sort of ununiformed, they frequently look like sort of marauding students, and this group did as well, that is actually reports through or is organized by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. And this is the same group that would come out, again, not in uniforms, not with official weapons, that put down the big demonstrations starting in 2009 against the Iranian government.
Why did they go after the British embassy? I thought the United States is the great Satan.
The United States may still win great Satan status, but the British have something we don't, an embassy. So, you know, the U.S. embassy was invaded in 1979. The hostage crisis followed. There have never been diplomatic relations that were restored between the United States and Iran after that. So the British were the next best thing, the U.S.'s closest ally, and a leader in the effort to invoke sanctions against the Iranians. In fact, if you look at the sanctions that got invoked over the past 2 weeks since the International Atomic Energy Agency turned out its latest and probably most forward-leaning report indicating that Iran has been working on nuclear weapons technology, the British sanctions against Iran, as or some of the other European sanctions, were much tougher than the American sanctions.
But now everybody kind of gathers, even Syria is talking about whether they should have the kind of relationship with Iran that they do after an incident like this, because security at embassies is considered sacrosanct in international diplomatic circles. So what was Iran thinking? Why do they think this is going to do them well?
Well, you know, you can ask that about a number of Iranian activities in recent times. You know, if you believe the story in the indictment, and of course none of it's been proven yet, about the Saudi assassination plot against the Saudi ambassador to the United States and some other attacks, why would Iran think that attacking the or killing the Saudi ambassador on American soil would work necessarily to their advantage and not prompt a greater confrontation? Why would it happen here? And so one of the big questions is, how high up the line are these decisions being made, or are they being made? Or isn't there just instead an increasing atmosphere in Iran of frustration at the West, anger at the sanctions, anger at the nuclear accusations, and people are just sort of acting out, perhaps without full top-level control?
How high up the chain does this go? How much is known?
In the case of the Saudi plot, the thinking was that it was known at the top of the Quds force, which is sort of a force that the Iranian Revolutionary Guards use abroad, frequently in coordination with Hamas and Hezbollah. In the case of the Basij force, which is the group that is believed to have been involved in the embassy attack, it's not clear how high up that went. It is interesting that the riot police in Iran moved in and detained a bunch of people as if they were trying to put this down. And from everything we can glean from the Iranian press, everybody who was detained has since been let go. The damage inside the embassy was far greater than people thought. Fortunately, nobody among the British staff were hurt.
Right, or taken hostage.
That's
when
right.
Something like this happens, Americans of a certain age will always think of the taking of hostages for 444 days at the American embassy, helping to defeat Jimmy Carter, and then with the release of the hostages coming simultaneously with President Reagan's inauguration in 1981. So we're not looking at anything like that with a bunch of Brits.
No, we're not, but I think that explains that clip you heard with the British pulling all of their own diplomats out and then announcing that they were throwing out all the Iranian diplomats in London.
You know, I hear war drums in some of the media analysis about Iran like I haven't heard since maybe Dick Cheney was in office and actually considering whether that was a good idea. Is there a growing feeling among Western leaders or in Israel that some kind of military action against Iran may be warranted?
There is certainly a feeling within the Obama administration that they want to avoid a direct confrontation. But we are seeing a much increased tempo of indirect confrontations that may be intended to relieve the pressure or need for something more or overt. We still don't know what caused the huge explosion, and it was enormous, at an Iranian missile testing base a week ago. But when we saw satellite photographs this week of what the base looked like before and after the explosion, there was nothing left over a vast area. So either they had the world's worst industrial accident or they've been hit again. There have been the assassinations, of course, of the Iranian scientists, which you and I have discussed before. Mm-hmm. So you're seeing a significant increase in what is either covert action against Iran or really bad luck for the Iranians.
So what were these recent findings about Iran's nuclear program that has tongues wagging about that again?
Well, the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is the group that sends the inspectors in and out of Iran, has been collecting for many years reports, evidence, both in Iran and from friendly intelligence agencies, mostly Western intelligence agencies that are friendly to the agency, and that is to say unfriendly toward Iran. So you may want to discount these by some degree. Mm-hmm. They finally made public those findings about 3 weeks ago, and they laid out a pattern of activity that seemed to indicate people working very hard on the technologies one would need to both design and explode a warhead. And that is something that you would not need to go do if you were just building civilian nuclear power, which is what the Iranians say they are doing. Now, there's some question about how well organized this was. And again, there's the evidence is that there was much more work before 2003, and it's been much less organized since then. Of course, 2003 is when there were revelations about how AQ Khan, the Pakistani scientist, helped Iran with a number of nuclear technologies. So the program may have been driven somewhat underground. It was a pretty damning report, but it didn't have a smoking gun.
David Sanger, New York Times chief Washington correspondent. As we talk about the U.S. and Iran, we'll talk about Pakistan, Egypt, maybe some other things, time permitting. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Gary in Queens has a question about the British Embassy incident. Hi, Gary.
Hi. I'm just speculating, but maybe the embassy was an intention of the government. Let's say you're the Iranian government and you want less spies in your country. They did capture 12 CIA agents recently, and maybe they're looking to clean house so that they can conclude their nuclear weapons research without scrutiny, and getting rid of the British embassy was one mm-hmm.
One way to do that. That's interesting speculation. David, what about that? How much do we generally assume that embassies are actually full of spies or free of spies?
Well, embassies frequently have spies built within them. It's no secret that the United States frequently, when posting CIA officials overseas, give them an embassy cover, and the British have done the same thing. But in Iran, one has to assume that almost anybody who's assigned as a diplomat to Iran from a Western country is assumed by the Iranians to be a spy, whether it's true or not. I'm not sure that closing the embassy would make a huge difference in that, because most of the embassy officials in Iran, foreign officials, don't have much freedom of movement. So, you know, what the Iranians are worried about is, you know, who's inside the nuclear program, whether or not the U.S. or its allies are sending drones or spy planes over Iran. So I'm not sure that the embassy alone would be much of an impediment to whatever covert intelligence gathering is going on.
Sheba in New Canaan, you're on WNYC. Thanks for calling, Sheba.
Thanks for taking my call. I am Iranian-American. I'm completely and vehemently against this regime. You know, I lost my childhood because of the revolution, and we had a beautiful country that has, you know, since been taken over for 32 years. So I'm against this regime. However, I think we're so obsessed with this nuclear issue. I mean, why shouldn't Iran have nuclear weaponry? They are surrounded by it. They are a signatory of the NPT, while Israel, Pakistan, and, you know, India are not. So I just think we should be focused on the human rights issues, you know, sanction Iran because they're terrible at human rights and a brutal regime. But we're so obsessed with this nuclear weaponry that it hasn't even been formed. Meanwhile, Pakistan's got how many of them? And, you know, we're not obsessed, frankly, enough with the dangers of that country.
What about that, David? We know Ron Paul, probably alone among the presidential candidates of either party, would make that same argument. Why are they so obsessed with Iran having nuclear weapons in what is already a bad nuclear neighborhood?
Well, it's a very good question. And just to take the question sort of backwards, the biggest obsession you hear in Washington, at least among policy officials who have to worry about it, is indeed about the Pakistani program. Why? Because right now nobody believes that Iran has yet built a nuclear weapon, but the Pakistanis have 100 to 110 and are building up to 200, and it's in a country that's obviously got a huge terrorism problem. So that is the number one obsession. I would say that Iran ranks right behind it, and the reason has more to do with how Iran might use its power within the region if it became a nuclear state. And what you're getting at is a big debate in Washington, which is you've had a succession now of three presidents, Clinton, Bush, and Obama, who have all said the United States will not tolerate a nuclear Iran. And yet you have a number of people in all three of those administrations who have said, but, you know, it may be inevitable, so we ought to begin to think about how to contain Iran's power. And that debate has never been resolved in Washington.
And what would Iran do to its neighbors if it had nuclear weapons? I know the concern is it would change the balance of power. It would give Iran even a bigger footprint of influence. But why? Because people think Ahmadinejad or a successor to Ahmadinejad just might be crazy enough to use a nuke or something else.
Well, one possibility is just crazy enough to use a nuke, but I think that's a very remote possibility because obviously the Israelis have, you know, several hundred. And, you know, in the world we live in today, fortunately, no one's likely to send off a nuclear weapon with a return address. What you're worried about is the nuclear weapon without a return address. And if you've got a country like Iran that is the largest, one of the largest state sponsors of terrorism, the concern is always that nuclear material could get slipped to a, you know, Hamas, a Hezbollah, some other terror group, and that it could be used as a terror weapon. Now, is that a remote possibility? Yeah. It's a, you know, extraordinarily low probability event. Could it also be a major problem if it happened? Yeah, there's probably, you know, nothing worse in the homeland security world than thinking of a nuclear 9/11. So that's the balancing power. And there are a lot of reasons you could think that Iran wouldn't ever go do that, including the fact that the science is gradually getting better at figuring out where a nuclear weapon material came from.
Iran even came up yesterday, as you probably know, when Vice President Biden made his surprise visit to Iraq. And it's a surprise because it's still not safe enough to announce that a vice president of the United States is coming there, but he attended the ceremony handing over control of the headquarters at Camp Victory to Iraq as U.S. troops officially leave as of yesterday. And listen to the prediction that he made about one way that U.S. influence will remain in the region.
There is no possibility of them having the capacity without the world reacting, not just the United States, the world reacting, if all of a sudden Iran was to move across its border and invade any of the countries in the region.
So he's in Iraq celebrating, in a way, the return of U.S. troops from there after that horrible and horribly divisive war. And what's he talking about? Whether the U.S. or Iran will have more influence over the new Iraq.
Right, and whether Iran would do what it did once before during the Iran-Iraq war and come over the Iraqi border. So this gets back to the previous caller's question. Why is everyone so obsessed with a nuclear Iran? Well, it's one calculation, if the Iranians did come over the border, to go push them back if they are conventionally armed. It's a very different calculation if they are nuclear armed. And your caller made the point that, you know, they're a member of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, and that's right. And North Korea, Pakistan, India, Israel, they're all not. But the Iranians have got to be looking around the world and saying, what mistake did Muammar Gaddafi make? Well, Gaddafi gave up his nuclear weapons program, even though it was in its infant stages, in 2003. And the Iranians are probably asking the question, would the U.S. and NATO have been in there bombing in Libya if they thought there was a possibility that Gaddafi had access to either a nuclear weapon or nuclear materials? Mm. And the guesswork is probably not. And they're probably right. It probably would not have happened.
David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times and author of the book The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges to American Power. And we've spent almost our whole time on Iran, which I think was worth it. But let me run through a couple of other things that we were going to talk about real quick. Pakistan, where a U.S. airstrike killed 24 Pakistani soldiers. The U.S. basically acknowledges now that this happened. But the latest, according to the Wall Street Journal today, is that U.S. officials say Pakistan gave the okay for the strike, believing that there were no Pakistani troops in the area, just Taliban militants. So it looks like there's some finger-pointing both ways at whose mistake it was.
There is a lot of finger-pointing, and you'll notice what hasn't happened this week. That while the President of the United States has issued a statement of regret that there was a loss of life, he has refused a request by the State Department to issue an apology to the Pakistanis. And the reason for that is they believe either the Pakistanis knew that the Taliban were firing from that area or that they had been in some way, you know, previously notified and were culpable in the incident themselves. So there's been no U.S. apology. And, of course, that's only inflamed the Pakistanis further. The Pakistanis have closed off two of the routes of supply of goods into Afghanistan, critical routes of supply, and they have also told the U.S. to vacate the Shamsi Air Base, which is where the U.S. had run a number of drones, although they'd become less dependent on that base in recent times.
And what's the U.S. government position on the Egyptian elections? If preliminary results get confirmed, it looks like Egypt will have a parliament with a majority of Islamist Party members. So will the Obama administration celebrate a free and fair election with a large and peaceful turnout, or denounce it or distance itself from it because of who won?
This is the $4 million question with Egypt, because if a revolution happens, as many in the administration warned back in February, it's rarely the people who start a revolution who end up finishing it, Iran being an interesting example of this from 1979. And so now the question is less, will there be an Islamist, much more Islamist as opposed to a secular government in Egypt and maybe some of the other Arab Spring states, but what kind of Islamist government? And my guess is that you're going to see the U.S. come to the conclusion they've got to embrace a apparently relatively fairly run election, although the election will be going on now still for months as it moves around the country. But then they're going to have to be campaigning very hard to make this a very moderate form of Islam that is running this government. And it's not clear the U.S. has very much leverage to do so.
It's not just Egypt. It's, interestingly, Morocco and Tunisia also electing Islamist-oriented governments. But, you know, again, that doesn't mean that they're going to be like the mullahs in Iran.
No, I mean, the effort here is to make these countries much more like Turkey and much less like Iran. So, you know, Turkey's got a largely big Islamist overlay, but a largely secular government that where the civilian government is in full control of the military.
But one of the tricky things is going to be when, let's say, the Muslim Brotherhood, seen as relatively moderate in Egyptian terms, might need to form a coalition in the parliament with the more radical Salafists in order to have a government. Governing
majority. Yesterday they didn't plan to do that, but you're absolutely right, Brian, that, you know, on some issues they're going to have to form a coalition. And, you know, that raises a lot of questions about the future of the peace treaty with Israel. It raises a lot of questions about what other roles the Egyptian government would play. And it raises a question within Egypt, which is, will the Egyptian military, which also was deeply suspicious of the Muslim Brotherhood, will they come to their own kind of peace with the Muslim Brotherhood, where both sides allow the other to share power, or will the military try to say, you know, the military's run this country for many years and done a pretty good job of it, we're going to stay in power? And that would be a whole different problem for the U.S.
David Sanger, Chief Washington Correspondent for The New York Times. David, thanks a lot. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And speaking of all those Americans coming home from Iraq, coming up next, we will play some excerpts from a video game for returning vets and their families. The question is, can playing this game called Family of Heroes help ease the return to civilian society? Stay with us.